Not only does it give the foundational character, that is, being, not doing, what I am, not what I do. And not only does it give the characteristics of the one ruled, but also, and here's where we left off, and we're going to begin, I want to say another word or two about the characteristics of the one ruled, and then we'll be looking at the corrective values and so on through the outline. Let's begin by reading chapter 5, 1 through 16 again. In addition to the all-inclusive characteristic blessedness, if my life is ruled by the King, I'm happy, I'm content. In addition to that, the Beatitudes list another 7 or 8 characteristics of the one who's ruled by the King. If I'm ruled by the King, I'm poor in spirit. If I'm ruled by the King, I mourn. If I'm ruled by the King, I'm gentle, meek. If I'm ruled by the King, I hunger and thirst. I'm full of mercy, pure in heart. I'm a peacemaker. Now, before leaving those descriptions, let me show you the corresponding couplet, the spiritual side that God ties in with that. In other words, when you look at words like poor and mourn and hunger and thirst and meek, you get the sensation of repulsion and you say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I like those words. Hunger and thirst and poor and meek and persecution. You say, I don't want that. That's a list of negatives. I don't want to be poor. I don't want to mourn. I don't want to be persecuted. And yet you notice that he ties in words like blessed. He said, how can you be happy when you're hungry? And how can you be happy when you're poor? How can you be happy when you're mourning? It looks like a contradiction of terms. But it isn't. The one who's ruled by the King is living in another kingdom. He's living in the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit, implied. Blessed are those who are poor to the kingdom of this world. Blessed are those who mourn in the kingdom of this world. Blessed are the poor in spirit. What? This is the kingdom of heaven. You see how he ties that in? He's not just saying, blessed are those who are poor, and then you say, oh, in the kingdom of heaven, I've got to be poor in spirit. He's not saying that. The opposite's true. You're rich in the kingdom of heaven. This morning, we had an opportunity to look at Proverbs chapter 8. Listen to this verse 11. Speaking about heavenly wisdom, it says, wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare to her. Verse 21, God says of those who seek Him, now listen to this, I endow those who love me with wealth. I fill their treasuries. What kind of wealth does He give to those who love Him? And how does He fill our treasuries? In this connection, listen to Job 22, 24 through 26. If you place your gold in the dust, the gold of Ophir, among the stones of the brook, then the Almighty will be your gold, and choice silver to you, and you will delight in the Almighty. Job 22, 24 through 26. Isn't that a marvelous thing? If you place your gold in the dust, the Almighty will be your gold, and choice silver to you. You see, poor is not bad if you understand true riches. And what he's saying is Colossians 2, 3, in Him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Blessed are the poor in spirit, to the kingdom of this world, because they're rich toward God. That's why they're so blessed.
What's the verse in
Job? Job 24, or rather 22, verses 24 through 26. Same thing's true of mourners. You see, mourning, as far as this world is concerned, the kingdom of this earth, not mourning in the kingdom of heaven, the opposite's true. Verse 4 says, they shall be comforted. In the kingdom of heaven, you're not mourning. In the kingdom of heaven, you're comforted. Verse 5, the meek are happy. Why? They inherit the earth. The kingdom of the earth thinks they are inheriting the earth. But the kingdom of earth doesn't have the earth. The kingdom of heaven has the earth. You find the Christian who's humble, who's meek. He's the one that inherits the earth. Who appreciates the sky and the flower and the trees and the forest? Recently, I went to a Bible conference in Maryland. Some of you went with me. And I had an occasion to walk by a river in a very wooded area. It was quite beautiful. There were the rocks and the waterfalls. It was just a beautiful setting, very postcard kind of a picture. I don't know who owns that property. I don't know who pays taxes on that property. But I'll tell you what, he didn't possess it any more than I did when I walked on. That was my property. And I enjoyed every step I took. The man ruled by King Jesus. The woman ruled by King Jesus. We're the ones that own the stars. We're the ones that own the moon. You drive down Ocean Drive, you take a good look at your ocean. It belongs to you. All things are yours, he said. And then he named not only men, we belong to each other, but he says all things are yours. Everything belongs to you. He's given you freely all things to enjoy. Only the Christian enjoys the earth. We're the ones that inherit it. And someday, in a way that my tongue can't express, he's going to literally work that out on the earth. And in a way we can only guess at, we're going to inherit the earth. Marvelous. Hunger is not bad. Verse 6, they're satisfied. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, they shall be satisfied. Verse 8, who's the one who seeks God? Who's the one who sees the Lord? The pure in heart, the pure in heart. You see, it sounds bad on the surface when you just read these paradoxes. It appears undesirable. But when you understand the kingdom of heaven, then you're not afraid of poor or mourning or gentleness or hungering. You're not afraid at all because we're talking about the kingdom of heaven, the real kingdom, the invisible kingdom. And in that kingdom, what are we doing? I'll tell you, we're being comforted. We're seeing God. We're inheriting the earth. We're receiving mercy. We're the sons of God. That's why he can say, blessed. Blessed are those. Blessed. Those are the characteristics of the one ruled by the king. All right, that brings us then to the third way that the Beatitudes serve as a wonderful introduction to this great sermon. Not only because it gives the foundational characteristic, namely what I am, not what I do. Not only because it describes in paradoxes the characteristics of those ruled by the king, but it also serves as a corrective value. And here's what I mean by that. The kingdom of the earth, they have surface ideas on so many things. The natural heart of man's very shallow. Veneer. The natural heart of man, they just chop off weeds at the surface. They never get down to it. But the Beatitudes are not like that. The Beatitudes are deep sea divers. The Beatitudes, they go fathoms. They go down into the depths, right into the soul. When you look at the Beatitudes, they touch being. They touch essence. They touch core. They touch heart. They touch spirit. Let me give some illustrations of this. Fact is, I'll give four illustrations of it. The first illustration is man's surface idea of happiness. Man has a surface idea of happiness. Now, I think the average person would understand happiness as Webster defines it. Listen to Webster's definition of happiness. The word happy literally means favored by hap. That's his first definition. Favored by hap. And then he goes on to say, favored by luck. Favored by chance. And you don't get a real, what we would call a definition, until you come to the third one, where he talks about one who enjoys, who has a sense of well-being because he's favored by luck. That's what happiness is, according to Webster's dictionary. He has peace, he has well-being. He has an agreeable sensation of pleasure because everything's going my way. Then you're happy when everything goes your way. The word happy, as you can notice from the sound of it, and the word happen, come from the same root. Happy. It's an Icelandic word. It has to do with the kingdom of the earth. And it can be summarized in these words. Happiness depends on what happens. That's the definition according to Webster. Depends on what happens. Happiness is dependent on circumstances. If things go well, you can be happy. If the circumstances are okay, then you can be happy. If you're healthy, if the kids are good, if it doesn't rain, if you get promoted, if you get a hit in your ball game, if your resources don't dwindle, if you don't get laid off, if you don't get a flat tire, if everything goes all right, then you can be happy. Happiness depends on what happens. But if bad things happen, then you can't expect to be happy. If you're unemployed, how can you be happy when you're unemployed? How can you be happy when you go shopping? The inflation is so bad. How can someone be happy in wartime, in famine, nakedness, peril? The Beatitudes tell you, the Christian can. The Christian can. Blessed are you, he says, verse 11, when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me, he says, rejoice. Be glad. Blessed are you. Happiness. Blessed are you who are poor, who have occasion to mourn, who are meek, who hunger and thirst. Happy are you. See, the kingdom of earth knows nothing about that. The kingdom of earth, their ideas of happy are built upon circumstances. But the Beatitudes take you deeper than that. In the kingdom of heaven, happiness is independent of circumstance. Don't answer. Just think. Are you a kingdom of earth Christian or a kingdom of heaven Christian? Does your happiness depend upon circumstances? If your happiness depends on circumstances, then you're a kingdom of earth Christian. You need to look again to the Lord. You need to be ruled by the King. Because according to the Bible and God's definition, here's how He corrects that false idea. It doesn't depend upon circumstances. You may have good Christian fellowship, or you may have none. It doesn't matter. Your happiness doesn't depend upon that. You may be young and strong and healthy. You may be old and blind and feeble. It doesn't matter. Your happiness does not depend upon that. You may be strong or you may be weak. You may have a pocket full of money, or a pocket full of holes. It doesn't matter. If you understand God's beatitude, it doesn't matter. You can be abounding or suffering loss. The joy of a Christian is deeper than Webster's happiness. It doesn't depend on hap. It doesn't depend on chance or luck or circumstances or what comes into your life. You can ride or walk, or be wheeled, or be carried, or stay home. It doesn't matter. The one ruled by the King doesn't care. Doesn't care if he wears shoes or if he goes barefoot, if he eats steak, or if he eats beans. he has a downy pillow or if he uses Jacob's rock, it doesn't matter. His contentment is deeper than that. His blessedness is deeper than that. The Apostle Paul was a Kingdom of Heaven saint. Listen to what he wrote in Philippians. He said, I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret. I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, of having abundance and suffering need. And then he gives the secret. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. See, our blessedness is a lot deeper than the world's happiness. That doesn't mean that we're that weird. We still feel. We still mourn. We still have sensations. Tears still warm our cheeks as well. We're still moved very deeply. But because we're ruled by the King, we have a deep-seated contentment, knowing that God is God, and He's my Father, and He rules my life, and all things are in control. And blessedness pervades our sorrow. That doesn't mean we don't weep. We just don't weep as those who have no hope. We have a deep contentment that is better, deeper, more cardinal than the world's happiness. Even at the grave of our loved ones, our heart is full of praise and rejoicing and thanksgiving, because what happens can't touch our joy. See, the Beatitudes correct the world's shallow thinking about happiness. There's a lot more surface ideas here in addition to happiness. The world, of course, because they have this, happiness depends on what happens. Therefore, if something bad happens, the way to make people happy is to attack what happens. And so you got great programs attacking poverty. And you got great programs attacking hunger. And great programs attacking disease. Because behind it all is no one will be happy if they're poor. So let's remove poverty so happiness will flood the world. It's a surface idea. They say we need good news before we can be happy. Well, we say that too. Except our good news is a different kind of good news. Our gospel says we don't need good news in order to be happy. That's our good news. We can be happy in a furnace. We can be happy in a pit. We can be happy in a den. We can be happy in a jail. We can be happy in a fish. That's our good news. That it doesn't matter, because blessed are those who live in the Kingdom of Heaven. There's a second surface idea that the Beatitudes correct, and that is the idea of a hungry heart. The idea of a hungry heart. The way the world measures a hungry heart is by the spirit of restlessness. Now, here's what I mean by that. You hear a lot of talk these days, especially about our young people, and it's usually expressed in words something like this. Our young people, our children, our kids, are turning to drugs and turning to alcohol and turning to sex and turning to crime and turning to cults and all kinds of false teaching, even Satan worship. And they're doing that because they're seeking for the truth. They're hungering. They're thirsting, and they don't know where to find it. And so they jump from one error to another, our poor kids. They jump from one frying pan into another. Let me ask this question. When a man turns to an idol, is he hungering after the true God? You see, according to the Bible, he's rejecting the true God. He's not hungering after Him. When someone runs from one false teaching to another, from Jehovah's Witness to the Mormons to the Christian Science and all these different cults, they're not seeking God. They're not hungering after God. They're rejecting God. They wouldn't be running to those things. Nobody seeks the true God and runs to drugs. Nobody seeks the true God and runs to alcohol. You run to drugs and alcohol and other things like that when you're rejecting the true God. See, the world says if a person has a hungry heart, he's in danger of false teaching. Because he's so hungry, he can get involved in anything. The Beatitudes check that and give you the real truth. Chapter 5, 6. They shall be filled. Doesn't say they shall be swallowed up by error. It says they shall be filled. I'll tell you what, I believe this with all my heart. The most invulnerable thing in the world is a hungry heart. You want to be safe, then ask God to give you a hungry heart. If you have a hungry heart, you're safe from error. You're safe from false teaching. Jesus says, if anyone seeks me, he doesn't say he's going to end up in false teaching. If anyone seeks me, he'll find me. If anyone hungers, they're going to be filled. If anyone thirsts, they're going to be satisfied. If anyone knocks, it's going to be opened. If anyone asks, they're going to receive. That's how the Bible approaches it. If you're really hungry, you're not going to be satisfied with the false, with the fake, with the fraud, with the counterfeit. I used to get a little worried before I would teach. I would think something like this. Now I know I'm only a man, and I have sources written by other men, and I don't have all the truth. And I'm sure many times my own ideas filter down and muddy up the pure grace of God. I know that's true. And then I used to think, what if I teach error? What if I make a mistake and say something wrong and someone latches hold of that? And they begin to follow my directions and they get all messed up in their life. What if somebody listens to me and gobbles up my error? I better not teach. Yeah, I'm afraid to teach. And I went through that in my life. But I believe the Beatitudes are saying this. Not if they have a hungry heart, they won't. That's a little paraphrase there, the Beatitudes. Jesus says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst, for they shall go astray. Is that what he said? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. They shall be filled. If you've got a hungry heart, you're not going to take anything I say that's not true. If you've got a hungry heart, God has put a discerning spirit in you. You'll spit it out. You'll throw it away. What is the one indispensable proof that you have a hungry heart? The one way you'll know you have a hungry heart, a hungry heart is a satisfied heart. If you're hungry, he said, you'll be filled. A hungry heart's a satisfied heart. See, the world says the way you can tell if someone's hungry is if he's empty. If he's empty, he's hungry. No, God says no. That's the world's way. That's the surface way. If you're empty, you don't have a hungry heart. Because God said if you had a hungry heart, you'd be filled. The world's hunger depends on emptiness, but not in the kingdom of heaven. I'll show you a hungry Christian. You find a Christian who's satisfied in Jesus, and that one will be hungering after God. You find the one most satisfied, most filled, and you found the one most hungry, most thirsty. Remember that wonderful hymn? I love to tell the story, written by Catherine Hankey. There's a verse in there, the last verse. I love to tell the story for those who know it best. Seem hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest. Those who know it best, those are the ones who hunger and thirst. The kingdom of heaven Christian is always hungering. He's not dissatisfied. Some people get the idea that in order to hunger, you've got to be dissatisfied. No, not in God's way of hungering. The opposite's true. I like what G. Campbell Morgan said about it. He asked the question, what is hungering and thirsting? And then he gave this answer. Divine discontent with everything unlike God. Oh, exactly right. You see, this is God's plan. That you enjoy the Christ you've seen by revelation, while you hunger after the Christ you have not seen. You follow that? Enjoy the Christ you've seen. Another way to say it, just walk in the light. As He's in the light. Until He gives you more light. And then walk in that light as He's in the light until He gives you more light. Then walk in that light. Always walk in the light you have. You're satisfied. You're filled. You're enjoying the light. You're enjoying the Lord. You're living in the radiance of His face. But you're saying in your heart, more. I want to see Him again. I want more of Him. You're not dissatisfied. You're content. You're filled. And then He increases your capacity. And then you're more filled. Then He increases your capacity. It's not that I'm half full today, three quarters full next week, and finally full a year from now. I'm full today. And more full tomorrow. And next week I'll be more full yet. Because He increases your capacity to know and to enjoy the Lord. That's what He's talking about. See, the world doesn't understand that. The world says these poor kids who are running to drugs, they're hungering after God. No, they're not the ones who are hungering. The ones who are hungering after God have found God. The ones who are hungering are the ones who are filled. Not the ones who are dissatisfied. But the ones who are satisfied in Christ. I tell you, once you find the truth, Christ, to seek after anything else is to seek a lie. You can't seek after anything else once you've found Him. And He's more delectable to your soul than honey is to your palate. Satisfied in Christ. It corrects that false idea of hungering and thirsting. Let me give you another surface idea that man has. Not only does he have a surface idea of happiness, a surface idea of hunger, but man also has a surface idea of meekness. The way the world uses the word meekness, in man's thinking, meekness is weakness. That's man's idea. That's the kingdom of earth. Matter of fact, Webster says about it, mild of temper, spiritless. That's what the word meek means. The kingdom of earth regards meekness with contempt. In the man, in the eyes of man, in the mind of the men of the world, you're a milk toast if you're meek. You're an invertebrate. No backbone. You're a chicken. You're a coward. Mamby-pamby. Or whatever other words you can come up with. Chapter 5:5 talks about meekness. Chapter 5:10 talks about persecution. Now remember, those are qualities of the same person. They're meek. They're turning the other cheek. But I'll tell you, they're tough too. They're persecuted. The way God uses the word meekness is not weakness. It has to do with trusting God. Trusting God to control unruly passions. Trusting God to enable you to turn the other cheek. When you're rebuffed, when you're rebuked, when you're slighted, when someone is rude to you, when someone is wrong. Meekness has to do with silent suffering. No complaining. Meekness has to do with that passive resistance. There's a strength in the meekness that God has. There's a bravery in it. A bravery that says, these are the principles of God. I know you must kill me for believing them. However, I will not recant. And whether or not God will deliver us out of the fiery furnace, we don't know. But we are trusting God, and it doesn't matter. That's weakness? No, that's meekness. That's strength. And that's the meekness as Jesus speaks of it in this particular sermon. See, the earth, the kingdom of earth says, leave them alone, and then they won't bother you. But the kingdom of heaven says, let the king rule your life. And maybe you can't leave them alone, and maybe they will bother you and persecute you. But that's okay. You stand firm in the Lord, and don't be afraid. That's meekness. It's the opposite of weakness. Tremendous courage. Tremendous strength. With the endurance of a martyr, you say, I'm not afraid of the flame. I'm not afraid of the sword. I'm not afraid of the rack. I will not flinch at the face of men. I'm not afraid of man whose breath is in his nostril. That's meekness. I'm trusting God. That's how he uses the word. Man has surface ideas about happiness, about hungering and thirsting, about meekness. Let me give you one other. In verse 9, Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers. Well, you hear a lot about that in the world. They have a surface idea of a peacemaker. I love to compare verse 8 with verse 9. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. You see, God ties those together. There can be no peacemaking apart from purity of heart. There cannot be. The world cries, peace, peace, but they have this awful surface idea, peace at any cost. That's how the world looks at it. When we pulled out of Vietnam, our president said we had an honorable peace. It was not. It was a dishonorable peace. Peace at the price of principles. The world is constantly at war, and in order to stop warring, they negotiate. And why do they negotiate? They negotiate in order to come up with compromise. You give a little and I'll give a little. We'll come up with something in the middle in order that will satisfy both of us and will avert the war. God's peace is not like that. He doesn't say peace at any cost. He says peace based on purity, no other way. I believe in peace. Mrs. Thatcher said today, I was so delighted to hear it. She said today, peace is our goal, but justice is our means. I was so glad to hear that. Whether she means it or not is another thing, I don't know. But God always bases peace on purity. It's always righteous peace. Now, these words are probably the wrong words to use, hard and soft, but it gets the idea across in your mind. Some words register hard in my mind. Here's what I mean by that. For example, if I hear a word like violence, if I hear a word like anger, vengeance, wrath, I say those are hard words. And there are some soft words. If I hear a word like comfort or sympathy or consolation or mercy, I say, ah, that's better. That's syrupy. That's soft. That's comforting. I like that. Sometime, I don't know which list to put peace in. I hear the word peace, I say, that's a soft word, until I look in my Bible. And when I read peace in the Bible, it falls under the other list. It's a hard word because it's based on purity. Jesus is called the Prince of Peace. And I think that's his most severe title in the Bible. If I were an artist and I could paint Prince of Peace, if I could put that on a canvas, I would paint him with fiery eyes and with a sharp two-edged sword. And if I could put motion in that, I'd have him wielding that sword. He gives peace. How? By carving away everything in your life that hinders peace. That's how he gives peace. Not peace based on nothing, but peace based on righteousness. God takes special care to put this arrangement in the Bible. When he talked about Melchizedek, he said, first, king of righteousness, then king of peace. What righteousness? When James described the wisdom from above, James 3:7, he said, pure, then peaceable. First pure. It has to be that way. First pure, always first peace, first peace, first peace, first peace, first, first peaceable. The millennium is going to be a kingdom of peace. Universal peace for 1,000 years. The lion will lay down with the lamb. The lion will eat straw like the ox. A child will play in the hole of an asp and not be bitten. Peace. Why peace? Because he's going to rule with a rod of iron. And he's going to break the offenders like a person breaks a pottery and shivers them all over the pavement. That's why there's peace. It's based on righteousness. It's based on justice. If you're not pure in heart, you can't be a peacemaker. See, the world registers peace. Oh yes, compromise, weakness, give and take, mamby-pamby. Not God. There's only one kind of peace in the Bible. Holy peace. There's no other peace but holy peace. There's no such thing as unholy peace. That's a contradiction of terms. Unholy peace. That's like a truthful lie. That's like an honest fraud. You can't have honest fraud. And you can't have unholy peace. The Beatitudes get to the heart of it. The Beatitudes get right down to the root. What's happiness? What's hungering and thirsting after God? What's real meekness? What's real peace? See, the world doesn't know anything about that. They are so surface. They're so on the top. God does. Let me give one more way the Beatitudes serve as an introduction. They not only give the foundational characteristic, the different characteristics of the one ruled by the king, they not only serve as great corrective values to man's surface thinking, but they're progressive. Now at this point, I'm going to erase the board, so remember everything else that's on there. The Beatitudes, as they're presented, are progressive in nature. In other words, they take you forward in the truth of God. Chapter 5, verse 3, blessed are the poor. 5, 4, blessed are those who mourn. 5, 5, blessed are the gentle. 5, 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst. 5, 7, blessed are the merciful. 5, 8, blessed are the pure in heart. 5, 9, blessed are the peacemakers. There's a progress in each of those. Before I show you the progress from one to the other, let me make a few comments about them as a whole. Notice the first. It says, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the last says, these are the sons of God. He's wrapping it up. He's telling you the whole story in those Beatitudes. Theirs is the kingdom. You want to see someone who owns the kingdom? If they live like that, theirs is the kingdom. These are the sons of God. All right, who are the sons of God? Each one builds on the one that goes before it. They're in God's order. You can't have this one before you have this one. Can't have this one before you have these two. And so on and so on. You'll see that order as I tried to share with you the principles connected with each one. You can understand right away why number one is number one. You can't begin in the Christian life until you're poor in spirit. Until you realize this world can't give you anything. You're poverty stricken. As far as getting anything from the kingdom of earth, they can't give you a thing. Nothing. Poor in spirit. If you want the kingdom of heaven, you got to say zero to the kingdom of earth. As far as the personal qualities are concerned, before you start your outreach, purity is the last one. You can understand why that would end the personal qualities. It's not surprising to find hungering and thirsting in the center. It starts by having nothing in the kingdom of earth. It proceeds to wanting nothing in the kingdom of earth. It continues by being content with the kingdom of heaven. Then as you move on, you go from the passive qualities to the active qualities. Let me chart it for you very simply. The first one says, I am nothing. In other words, I can expect nothing at all from the kingdom of earth. They have nothing to give. I am nothing. Poor in spirit. Mourning is an advance on that. It's the same idea. But mourning is, I want nothing. Now I'm dissatisfied with the kingdom of earth. And the more I go on in the Lord, the more grieved my soul begins to groan, like this creation longing for the redemption. And the more you go on in the Lord, the more you mourn to be out of this world system and all that is represented by it. I am nothing, then there's an advance. I want nothing. Blessed are the meek, the humble, those who trust God for strength, who are receiving from God. You begin to see, I am satisfied in the kingdom of heaven. You're moving now from one kingdom to the other. I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing here, I'm not here, I'm not have this, I'm satisfied with that. Not only satisfied, I'm hungry. And I thirst that, I want more. It's a progress. I have nothing here, I want nothing here, I'm satisfied there, I want more of heaven. You see the progress as you move on? And then you move on into the active one. These are sort of passive. Then you move into the active characteristics. Blessed are the merciful. Now you'll see some changes taking place in your life. In the kingdom of earth, you've learned one principle. I love me. That's the principle of earth. Self. It's the opposite of merciful. Unlike me. Selfless. Moving out toward others now. Unlike me. Blessed are the pure. Like Him. Do you see it? If you just say it all in a sentence, you'll see the progress. I have nothing here. I want nothing here. I trust Him. I want more of Him. He's changing me. I'm becoming like Him. You see the progress? And finally, when it's all over, now you have a ministry. Now you're a peacemaker. Now you can touch the world. I believe this is intentionally designed by God to show. It starts off, this is the kingdom of heaven. These are the sons of God. You're being ruled by the King. Are these characteristics in your life and increasing? You see, this is a wonderful introduction to the sermon because here you have all the eggs in one basket. He gives you the whole show first. Then you'll go through the sermon and he'll take it apart in little pieces. All right, let's move along in our outline. A good way to approach the Beatitudes is to look at the terminal points. In other words, how does it begin and how does it end? Before sharing with you, let me give you just a little background by reminding you of the message of Matthew. The way of the King is the way of the King's servant. Jesus walked this way. The way of the kingdom of heaven. And because he walked this way, he was rejected. He was put upon a cross. It was the path of rejection. You see, the kingdom of earth is not only the opposite of the kingdom of heaven, it's in opposition to the kingdom of heaven. It's not only paradox. These are their principles, these are ours. But those principles are at war with one another. The seed of the serpent is at war with the seed of the woman. It isn't a matter, I'll take my principles, you take yours. The kingdom of earth says, you take my principles or we'll kill you. And the more you get the principles of the kingdom of God, the more you're going to be hated by the world. They're in opposition. If I follow the King, if my life is ruled by the King, if I walk as the King walked, what will it look like? Well, look at the terminal points. 5-3, how does it begin? It begins with a great big zero. That's how it begins. As far as this earth is concerned, as far as its principles are concerned, as far as its ways are concerned, as far as its goals are concerned, poor in spirit, poverty, zip, zero, zilch, nothing. How about worldly fame? Give that a great big egg, great big zero. How about worldly wisdom? Can't go after it anymore. Another big zero for that. Oh, yeah, but I can get wealth. Big zero. No, no. You're in the kingdom of heaven. But I get involved in entertainment. Nope. Zero on that. Worldly business. I'll make my... Zero. Zero. What about worldly music? Zero. Zero on everything. What about finding contentment here? Zero. Can I go into the kingdom of earth and at least find a life partner? Zero. Poor in spirit? Zero. Can I get a good, honest job? I doubt it. Zero. The world system has nothing. As far as the earth is concerned, that's how you begin. With a great big zero, coming to the place where you recognize they have nothing to give you. And the only thing they finally give you, the moth can get, the rust can get, the thieves can get. It's going to have canker, it's going to have rust, it's going to decay, it's going to die. That's how it begins. How's it end? Well, look at 10 through 12. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you, persecute you, and say all kinds of evil against you. For what? Because you were meek. Because you hungered for righteousness. Because you were pure in heart. What do you think? Isn't it amazing? How's it end? Same way his ended. You're going to be persecuted. You're going to be lied about. You're going to be hated. As far as this world is concerned, it starts with a great big zero and it ends up with a cross. It's the kingdom of heaven. You want to walk it? Just because you're poor. Just because you're gentle. Just because you mourn for something better and lasting and enduring. Because you're merciful. Because you're clean. Because you want peace based on purity. They're going to hate you. They're going to reject you. They're going to throw you out. You can expect that. Because the kingdom of earth is not the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of earth is at war with the kingdom of heaven. Well, that brings us to the end of the introduction. Let me clinch it for you as the king clinched it. He gave a double illustration. Beginning of verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt has become tasteless, how would it be made salty again? It's good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. The illustration is of salt and light. The Christian is called the salt of the earth. The Christian is called the light of the world. Now, before looking at those illustrations in detail, let me give you the main message of salt and light. I believe the main message of salt and light can be summarized in one word: influence. Influence. Here's what Webster says about influence. I appeal a lot to Webster tonight. Here's influence: the power of producing an effect without an apparent force. The power of producing effect without an apparent force. The message of Matthew's gospel: when your heart is like this, the world will hate you. But what about this? Influence. Testimony. Missions. Soul winning. World redemption. Salt of the earth. Light of the world. That's the kind of life that has an influence. When you're going toward Him and the world is rejecting you because you contradict its principles and you leave no cloak for their sin, that leads to world redemption. The Beatitudes presented not what you did, but what you are. And what you are produces influence. Not what you do, not what you say, not where you study. He doesn't say you have salt. He doesn't say you dispense light. You are salt. You are light. It's what you are. This is so wonderful because this is God's method of evangelism. And may I say, 1,000 light years removed from the evangelism that has burned our people, burned the churches. If I spend 100% all of my time knowing God and being what He makes me, namely this, if I spend all my time there, I am salt. I am light. There's no other way to be salt and light. The only way not to be salt and light is to neglect being and start doing. And once you start doing and neglect being, you lose your influence. You lose your witness. You lose your testimony. And God loses His reputation on the earth. Christians always talk about being a blessing. Oh, I want to be a blessing. You can't be a blessing unless you're blessed. Blessed are you. If you're blessed, then you can be a blessing. But if you're not blessed, you can't be a blessing. Blessed are the poor, and blessed are those who mourn, and blessed are the meek and the hungry. And when I'm blessed, then I can be a blessing. If I'm salt, what will be the main influence in my life? I believe the principle of salt is this. Salt is a preservative. It prevents corruption. It guards from impurity. It prevents decomposition. It does other things too. It gives flavor, creates thirst, makes you thirsty. It corrodes. But I believe in the illustration Jesus had in mind. If you are being ruled by the King, if these are the characteristics of what you are, your character, then you're going to be a purifying influence on the earth. Now the disciples knew what He was talking about because they were fishermen. And they didn't have freezers in those days. And their fish would decay very rapidly without salt. They knew what salt was. And they used it all the time to prevent decay and corruption. You lay those fish out in the Galilean sun, it won't be very long when they'll say, "Where's the salt? Please pass the salt." Because that prevented the corruption. I think one of the main ways God's going to use us in our lives as we become what He wants us to be is by a restraining influence. Now, let me give a practical illustration like of this. Again, don't answer, just think. Do people feel comfortable in your presence telling smutty stories, dirty jokes? Do they get red-faced when they swear and take the Lord's name in vain? If they're in your presence, do they ever apologize and say, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that, I know you're a Christian, blah, blah." They ever say anything like that? Then you're salt. You're preventing corruption. It's a sad commentary on our relationship with the Lord when they're not embarrassed in our presence. When they can, in our presence, cut somebody down. When they can gossip, when they can criticize in our presence, then we're not salt. You see, what we are is going to produce character, and we will be salt. It's the illustration of preservation. Now, before leaving this, let me just say a word on 13. I'd like to just finish this up, if you don't mind. It won't take much longer, okay? Verse 13 says, "Good for nothing, thrown out, trampled underfoot." Let me give you a principle of Bible interpretation before we touch this. It's a simple one. You've heard it many times. Take the passage in its context. If you're going to understand what God's talking about, take it in its context. Interpret the details in terms of the main message. Now, we've been talking about verses 1 through 16. You know pretty much what it's about. Is the subject in those 16 verses the doctrine of eternal security? Is that what he's talking about, losing your salvation? He's not talking about that, and yet people have interpreted this. Oh, the salt lost its savor. Now throw it out and trample it underfoot. They lost their salvation. He's not talking about losing your salvation. The subject of these verses is the Christian's influence. That's the subject. And when verse 13 says, good for nothing, and thrown out, and trampled underfoot, he's not saying you're going to lose your salvation. He's saying you're going to lose your savor, not your Savior. He's saying you're going to lose your influence. You're going to lose your testimony. The Scots translation words it this way, if the salt has lost its tang. Well, a lot of Christians have lost their tang. And what that means is, because they're not going forward in this, they have no influence on the world to prevent corruption. None. As far as influence is concerned, an awful lot of what the world calls soul winning has no influence. Doesn't do a thing to prevent corruption. Has no power, has no savor, because the salt is not salt. And if salt is not salt, it's worthless. I can salt meat. I can salt fish. But I can't salt salt. If the salt lost its flavor, there's no way to salt salt. It's impossible to salt salt. This has nothing to do with salvation. It has everything to do with influence. If I'm being this, then I am salt. I don't have to worry about trying to witness. I am salt. You are salt. Someone says, but I witness faithfully. I hand out gospel tracts every day. I visit the sick. I teach a Sunday school class. I preach at jails or at nursing homes. I hold children's meetings. I teach in my home. The question is not, do you salt? But are you salt? It's not what you're doing. Are you salt? Are you poor in spirit? You say, well, no, not really. Then I don't care how many tracts you hand out. No influence. I don't care how many times you preach. No influence. Are you gentle? Are you meek? Are you trusting God? Are you mourning? If you're not, I don't care what you're doing. No influence. Influence is based on being. Being is what you are, not what you do. And it comes from being ruled by the King. Your one and only responsibility in the Christian life is to walk in an unbroken union with Him. That's it. To know Him and keep on knowing Him. And as you hunger and thirst after Him, you are salt. You are salt. It doesn't say, do you salt? It's, are you salt? Verse 14 through 16, he gives another one, not only salt, but light. Bible scholars tell us there are different words in the Greek for light. One is phos, P-H-O-S. One is luknos. The word phos means to give light, the source of light. This is the word that's used for the glory of God. It says in 1 Timothy 6 that He dwells in inapproachable light. Phos. In John 1 where He says, I am the light of the world. Phos, the source of light. The other one is derived light. Luknos, derived light. It means a lamp. Since Christians are called the light of the world, which word did the Holy Spirit use? The source of light or derived light?
Derived light.
Derived light. Wrong. You lose, we check. I set you up. As far as the world is concerned, we're the source of light. As far as our own hearts are concerned, it's derived. We know where it comes from. But as far as the world's concerned, He uses the strong word. He says, you are the light, the source of light in the world. That's a tremendous statement Jesus made. A tremendous statement. You're the phos of the world, the source of the light of the world. We're talking about testimony. We're talking about influence. We're talking about soul winning. We're talking about redemption. The thrill of this is that I don't have to work at it. All I have to do is know God. All I have to do is be. All I have to do is lay hold of Him. And then I become an influence. I become the source of light. I become the salt on the earth. When my life is ruled by the King, I'm an influence. I used to misunderstand verse 14 and 15. The city set on a hill, the lamp under a bushel. I used to think that God was saying something like this. Don't hide your light. Don't hide your light, Christian. Don't be ashamed. Don't be silent. Don't be bashful. Don't hide your light under a bushel. And then I'd try to think of different bushels under which people hide lights. And there would be the bushel of pride, or the bushel of education, or the bushel of laziness, or the bushel of unconcern, or all that kind of thing. And I used to think that's what he was saying. Don't hide your light under a bushel. But he's not saying don't hide your light. He's saying you can't hide your light. That's what he's saying. There's a big difference. Light is essentially diffusive. I think his illustration is this. King James calls it bushel. It's peck measure. They had a peck measure in which they carried the corn. And a man comes along and he says, I'm going to hide the light under the bushel. I.e., that is, an hour later or 2 hours later or the next day he's going to go back and use that light. You put light under a bushel. And then you go back and you try to use it. Where'd that go? I know I put it under there. I put that light right under that bushel, and now it's gone. His point is, you can't hide light under a bushel. Fact is, those bushels were made of straw if you tried to hide it, and their lights were made of flame. All right, you know what would happen to that peck measure if you put a candle under it. He wasn't trying to say some people, in order to hide the light, put it over a bushel. That would be crazy. You'd set the thing on fire, and you still couldn't hide it. What he was saying is, a city on a hill can't be hid. Can't be. You can't put a city on a hill and hide it. You can't. And you can't hide light in a bushel. I can't put light in a box and look in the morning and say, now where in the world did that light go? You can't. It's not possible. Neither is it possible, Christian, to be made like Him and not be an influence. It's not possible. It's not possible to go after Christ and not be salt. It's not possible to go after Christ and not be light. The fact is, the only way to be an influence is to walk the way the King walked. He went after God. That led to rejection and to world redemption. Let me close with this. The simplicity of this whole first section, the subjects of the kingdom, are in the simple words of verse 16. Let your light so shine. He doesn't say shine ye. He says let your light shine. Let it. Now letting is not something you do. When you let, you don't do anything. You just don't stop someone else from doing something. When you let, you allow. That's all let means, is to allow. Let your light shine. You don't have to do anything. Just let it shine. Let God do it. Let God do it. And you go after this. What you are determines what you do. And then I'll see your good works. What good works? Witnessing and driving school bus and singing in the choir? No. Go back to the qualities. If you're gentle, any good works going to follow that? If you're persecuted, any good works going to follow that? If you're poor in spirit, is that going to have any kind of an outworking in your life? Those are the good works he's talking about. The good works that are an outgrowth of a relationship, that are the byproduct of being, the character. If you are this, that's going to produce. And they're going to see that light. It's going to be an influence. It's going to be a prevention of corruption. That's the introduction to the great Sermon on the Mount. He's going to get into the meat of it after this. He wanted to give you a taste first. This was one of the most tremendous sermons ever preached. And he probably preached it in 20 minutes. Mankind has been studying it ever since. Any comments or questions about the first 16 verses? I know we touched a lot of it on the surface, but Donald.
What happens to those that are unwilling to step out concerning their, their faith?
That's not an issue. The only issue is this. If they're going on to know Him, they don't have to worry about bravery to witness or anything like that. They'll be a witness. They'll be an influence. And it won't always be sitting across the table with an open Bible. Sometime it will. You can't hide a city like this. You find a Christian like that, he's not hidden. Can't be. Because it's in such contradistinction to this world system. God give us people like this.
Yes. He's also talking collectively, isn't he? Of the believers, like the cities on the hill that could be
believers. Any truth that can be used for the body can be used for any member of the body. And any truth that can be used for any member of the body can be applied collectively. All church truth is personal truth, and all personal truth is church truth. So, all right, let's bow together. Our Father, we do thank You so much for Your Holy Spirit. We pray, Lord, that You'd work in our heart, not what I think this means, but everything You know it means. Make us sick of the kingdom of this earth. Burn in our hearts the kingdom of heaven. We ask it in Jesus' name.